Get your tickets now at cinematheque.qc.ca. Co-presented by the Cinémathèque Québécoise and CKUT.
My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of Hersey. The voice of Hersey. The voice of Hersey coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Mycelium, you're listening to Audio Smut on CKUT 90.3 FM, and today, December 6th, marks the 61st day of the genocide perpetrated against Palestinians in Gaza by the illegal Israeli occupation. I'm very grateful to be joined in the studio by scholar, teacher, and activist Dr. Nelly Kurito. Hi. Nelly.
Hi, Mycelium.
Natalie is an associate professor and program and practicum director for the Interdisciplinary Studies and Sexuality Program at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute at Concordia University. She has published her research in both academic and non-academic venues on topics related to sexuality, solidarity, pedagogy, kinship, and attachment, within the context of social movements, gender and sexuality studies, and activist responses to conditions of war in the Middle East. Natalie, do you want to give us a little more information about your background and your work and what brings you here today?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thanks for having me. I guess maybe the easiest thing to do is to just trace the trajectory of how my work ended up focusing both in my academic work and my activist work on Palestine solidarity activism, and in particular queer Palestine solidarity activism. So maybe I should just go back to when I was doing my master's degree at McGill University. It was 2006, I was in the middle of my master's, and the State of Israel waged war on Lebanon, and it was probably a moment that really politicized me in a way that I hadn't been politicized before, around the geopolitics of the Middle East and how gender and sexuality were being framed in the context of larger kind of global conflicts and framing of the Middle East as a kind of geopolitical site for the West. And part of that was because at the same time that a war was being waged in Lebanon, there was also a World Pride being planned in Jerusalem, and there was World Out Games being planned in Montreal. And the convergence of these three things, the celebration of gay rights, the kind of international mobility of gay athletes, and the circumstances of war really brought into stark contrast for me the kind of contradictions around celebrating gay rights as somehow separate from the conditions of people's freedom from violence and state violence in particular. And in particular, a group of activists from Lebanon were supposed to come to Montreal for a gay human rights conference that was happening just prior to the World Out Games in Montreal. And because of the war, they weren't allowed to come. And there was no official statement that was made by the conference organizers. And this kind of launched a group of people in Montreal to organize in solidarity around the circumstances of the war, to denounce the war, and also to try and fundraise to support relief work that was happening in Beirut at the time. And this really launched my activism in what eventually became queer Palestine solidarity activism, but I think more specifically queer activism around the structures of state violence, and in particular around the Israeli state's role in both mobilizing and weaponizing gender and sexuality in relation to structures of apartheid and occupation and reinforcing state violence, especially around complicity and the circulation of narratives in the global north and in the West in particular. So that became the basis of the research I did for my master's thesis. And then I went on to do a PhD at the University of Toronto. And soon after moving to Toronto, I got involved with a group that had newly formed in 2008 called Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. And QAIA, for short, became the central focus of my activism for many, many years in Toronto. And I ended up writing my dissertation around doing transnational queer solidarity activism through my own relationship to organizing within the social movement. And so that translated into more than a decade of organizing and research and writing in this area. And I think maybe the larger circumstances around that kind of organizing had to do with a development that happened in the early 2000s around how states were using human rights discourses to justify state violence. So we started to see, especially around the war on terror, in 2001, the then president of the United States, George W. Bush, use the language of saving women from the repressive practices of the Taliban as justification for why war in Afghanistan and Iraq was necessary. So the use of gender-based rights were already being deployed and circulating quite a bit in war and terror discourses. And very soon after that, in 2005, the State of Israel launched a public relations campaign, an international public relations campaign under the heading Brand Israel, to try and rebrand the public image of the Israeli state away from an image that exclusively focused on human rights violations and war imagery, and instead kind of surrounded the larger narratives around the Israeli state that focused on kind of more positive sides of Israel without diminishing the reality of violence, but kind of drowning it out, perhaps, is the best way to describe it. And so the Israeli state, heavily funded not only a domestic research campaign, but also a global campaign to market and fund research innovations and technology, green energy, arts and culture, tourism and gay rights. So these all became areas where intentional outreach into the global north and western countries, you know, came through funding from the Israeli state for arts and cultural events. We started to see spotlights on, for example, Tel Aviv as a cultural center. We saw, you know, major money coming in from the Israeli state to send artists and cultural workers as ambassadors for the state of Israel unofficially to, you know, international events and venues to promote this image of the Israeli state as a place that is more than a place where violence happens. And part of this was targeted campaigns towards encouraging gay tourism to Israel. And so we started to see more and more advertising that targeted gay communities in North America. And Toronto in 2005 became a testing ground for one of these campaigns. And so by 2008, there was already 3 years of outreach that had been done in the city of Toronto around encouraging gay people to travel to Tel Aviv, specifically Tel Aviv for its gay nightlife and beach culture. And when Queers Against Israeli Apartheid formed, it really formed as a way of responding to those circumstances in the way that Toronto in particular had been a kind of testing ground for some of these strategies. So that's kind of a bit of the backstory on Quaya, and I can go into some more of that as we go along.
Thank you also for kind of an overview of how the queer community kind of became a target of that PR campaign, and mm-hmm. the context you just gave around arts and culture also like makes me understand more accurately why it's such a big deal when artists go and play concerts, for example, in Tel Aviv. So thank you for that. And in the same kind of line of thinking about the history of queer solidarity with Palestine, how would you describe it now? Like, where is it standing mm-hmm. now? And what's kind of missing from that picture? What's your vision of a queer solidarity with, like, a transnational queer solidarity with Palestine for the future?
Oh, that's a really great question. Maybe I'll go back a little bit more too, and just say that there had already been a long history of feminist solidarity with Palestine, and also within Israel, like, of women who were activists against the occupation. And so, for example, Women in Black and other organizations that had, you know, been for a long time trying to oppose the continuation of the occupation, the expansion of the settlements, calling for the return of refugees, and also, you know, the BDS movement that started in the early 2000s, that was a response from civil society, Palestinian civil society, calling for the international community to participate in a boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign to encourage the state of Israel to comply with international law, dismantling the illegal separation wall that Israel had built, allowing for the right of return of refugees and ending the illegal settlement and occupation of Palestinian territory and land. And so so those movements were kind of already setting the stage for both, you know, forms of activism for people to focus on in the global north and in Western countries, the BDS movement in particular, and this kind of like foundation of feminist organizing. And the kind of emergence of queer solidarity movements in particular is kind of interesting. The first group that officially kind of formed in North America around Palestine solidarity was a group in the Bay Area that formed in 2001 called QUIT, or Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism. And they were one of the first groups that started to organize. And then within Palestine itself, there were a few groups that started to form in the early 2000s. So Aswat, which is a kind of feminist LGBTIQ+ kind of women focused organization, formed in 2003. And then Al Kaus, which is more of like a queer organization, formed in 2007. And so Quaya kind of like fit a little bit into the trajectory of all of these groups starting to form and organize in the early to late 2000s across like that first decade of the 21st century. And since then, there's been a lot of proliferation of this kind of activism. So after Quiet Toronto formed, a bunch of other Quiet, you know, branches formed in different places. There was a Quiet Vancouver that has recently restarted organizing again together. I think there might have been a Quiet New York, but I can't quite remember. It's been a little while. I think there was one maybe somewhere in Europe. A bunch of different groups. And there have been people who have been organizing through queer solidarity with Palestine without having official groups called that, you know. So lots of queer groups that have done anarchist and anti-imperialist organizing work have done Palestine solidarity work. So it definitely, you know, doesn't originate in the 2000s, but it's really when it gains like a kind of queer visibility in the 2000s in that way. And then I think that the queer movement in solidarity with Palestine reached a kind of apex in 2012. There was a World Social Forum that focused on Palestine in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And it was a convergence of activists from around the world who were doing Palestine solidarity organizing. And within the World Social Forum, there was a separate kind of connected gathering for queer organizers from across the world who met to share experiences, resources, and strategize together. And this is when we started to see like really the acceleration of kind of transnational campaigns that were mobilizing and coordinating in their efforts to really disrupt the kind of naturalization of this kind of gay tourism industry thing, this what we were calling pinkwashing that I think I'll chat about a little bit more soon. That, I think, really illustrated a kind of moment in queer Palestine organizing. There was a kind of network that was loosely affiliated through Pink Watching Israel, which was a website and a network of organizers who were documenting forms of pinkwashing in the context of the Israeli state, and that were mobilizing campaigns to do solidarity activism with queer Palestinians. And members of Alkaus traveled around North America in 2012, I think, on a kind of speaking tour, talking about the experiences of queer Palestinians in particular in the West Bank, who were citizens of Israel also, and about the conditions in Gaza at the time. So that was kind of like where things were then. And then I think at the start of the Syrian war in 2011, a lot of people, it shifted a lot of things around the Palestine organizing. And so I think things kind of decelerated in the queer movement after that. Also, the Brand Israel project focused less on queer, like queer tourism, queer outreach, sexual rights kind of discourses, and focused more on partnerships with universities, institutional and technological development, partnerships in research and development with corporations, and focusing in on mobilizing, I guess, both governments and university administrators to kind of normalize the structure of apartheid through like official forms of institutional partnership. And we're today, I think, in a moment when we see really the repercussions of about a decade of that kind of organizing work that's happened. I think a lot of the ways that universities have not only, you know, their investments in corporations that profit off of the conditions of apartheid and war, but also, you know, most universities now have, you know, well-funded institutional partnerships, travel abroad programs, you know, there's international research funding sources that encourage and fund partnerships between researchers in North American institutions and universities and Israeli institutions and universities. And so this is one of the ways that the kind of embeddedness of these systems naturalize those kinds of conditions. And we also, I think, see just the effects of, you know, the less visibility, less public visibility, and more, I guess, quiet development of those kinds of relationships. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot less in the media, a lot less in the news, a lot less public, like advertising that's coming about, and more happening, you know, through organized tours with university administrators that are planned to come to Israel and travel and see the universities and build partnerships in those ways. So, so today, since the start of the genocide, we're seeing the revival of a lot of queer activist groups. And so, you know, Kwaya Vancouver has restarted organizing. There's a new group that has formed in Toronto called Queers for Palestine. There's a screening series that's happening called Queers Against Genocide. That's been happening internationally. Actually, it's happening this week. Mm-hmm. And those partner with different groups across the world to do film screenings. It's Queer Cinema for Palestine. No, Queer Cinema Against Genocide, or I can't remember what it's called. Oh, geez. Okay, I should try and remember what it really is. So that's, I think, like the kind of past, the present, and then for me, the future. One of the things that I would really love to see is actually the end of apartheid. You know, and I think that a version of what that could look like, that to my mind would be the most ideal form, is one in which it's not only, you know, a liberation from the structured of an apartheid system, but like a full kind of intersectional, transformative context in which we see liberation broadly understood. So not just for Palestinians more broadly, but for everybody who is living in the region, a context where people get to participate in democratic society and where decriminalization and, you know, diversity of gender expressions and sexual orientations and subject positions is articulated and amplified. And in particular, this is important because there are also a lot of people who are not Palestinians and not Jewish Israelis who are in Palestine and Israel. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of foreign workers. There are a lot of, displaced migrants. And we need to think about the larger context that shapes their lives and that we know people have been affected who are people on temporary visas or who are part of diasporic communities living within Israel and Palestine who have been affected by the circumstances of state violence as well.
I can only agree, and thank you so much for this really thorough overview of that history. I think for a lot of people kind of just joining the fight in this kind of acute moment, it's really interesting to see how it's, you know, liberation is a constant struggle, and it's been sustained by activists, you know, for as long as the Israeli occupation has been happening. This is a chunky question, but you're a teacher, so I trust that you can you can summarize. Can you please define and summarize for our listeners what pinkwashing and homonationalism are? Who coined these terms and to what intent?
Yes, absolutely. It's simple. It'll take me 2 minutes. Just kidding. It'll take a little longer than 2 minutes. But so pinkwashing is, generally speaking, a way of describing the way that gay rights or sexual rights or gay subjects are used to either distract attention away from the violation of human rights more broadly or structures or forms of violence or to justify them. So, for example, you know, oh, well, you know, the most common pinkwashing slogan we hear is, you know, Israel is the only safe place for gay people in the Middle East. That's what we kind of like quintessentially see as a pinkwashing message. So basically pinkwashing is kind of like whitewashing, this concept that comes out of the critiques of corporations that try and cover over their violation of, of law or environmental devastation, with, you know, like charitable work or those kinds of messages. And actually the term pinkwashing was first used to describe the Pink Ribbon campaign, which is not the Pink Ribbon campaign specifically, but the way that corporations took up the Pink Ribbon campaign. So this is like starting in the 1990s and then moving into the early 2000s, the Pink Ribbon campaign partnered with corporations to do like breast cancer awareness, month activities, and a lot of corporations adopted like the color pink and like buy these things for breast cancer awareness, including like drilling for oil breast cancer awareness, or you know, it's the irony, or selling products that include carcinogens that cause breast cancer. breast cancer awareness. It's really insidious. And so it's funny because it's so crass and so like insulting in this way. But so people started to critique the use of like the pink ribbon and breast cancer awareness as this kind of structure for it. And then when it started to happen that we saw this kind of practice of using gay rights to justify state violence in the Middle East, people really identified that as the same thing. So people started to call it pinkwashing. And in the mid-2000s, like pinkwashing kind of took up some steam. I think really by 2009 or 10, that's like really when people started to like amplify the language of pinkwashing as the critique. And before that, there was like a little bit, you know, people were using the critique, but describing it in a lot more detail. So they would like explain what I just did right now. Every time they would describe this scenario of using gay rights to justify state violence. And so pinkwashing became like a great term to be able to circulate and mobilize it for solidarity activists, and also to kind of gain and educate a public around what was happening in relation to how sexuality was being mobilized and used in a context of state violence. Of course, we have pinkwashing in Canada. It's not that Israel has a monopoly on pinkwashing. Every state in the global north does pinkwashing in some form. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the United States did a lot of it in the context of the war on terror and continues to do so. Canada as well. And, you know, we see that in examples of how the tar sands have been marketed in Canada as a just a kind of parallel example. So, homo nationalism is like if pinkwashing is the kind of like meat in the sandwich, or I don't know if you're, maybe that's like a little bit like the filling of the sandwich. Homo nationalism is like the bread or like the gluten-free like wrap of some kind. You know, what the thing that holds it together that is like the framework for it. So homo nationalism is a term that was coined by a scholar named Jasbir Puar, who at the time was a professor in women and gender studies at Rutgers University. I could have gotten the department name wrong. And who now is based at the University of British Columbia. And she wrote a book called Terrorist Assemblages. And in that book that was published in 2007, she kind of coins the term homo nationalism. That's combining a couple things that people in the early 2000s are really critiquing and developing a critical understanding of in the convergence between, I guess, like queer theory and queer critique and critiques of neoliberalization and nationalism. And what Puar did was she observed and articulated the ways in which sexuality and sexual rights in particular had been folded into the project of nation building through a kind of contradictory set of principles. And one of those is that for Western nation states like the United States, when we talk about foreign policy and we talk about in particular kind of global foreign policy around circumstances of war and state violence, the United States, you know, uses and deploys the language of gay rights or human rights or women's rights as an illustration of the civilizational divide and advancement and centrality of the liberation and freedom of the United States or of America or of Western countries in juxtaposition to the inherent incivility or backwardness of places in the global south, and in particular the Middle East. And this is in part of the rhetoric and discourse that got circulated in the war on terror in the early 2000s. But for Puar, it was more than just a set of rhetorical tools. It wasn't just about the language that people were using. It was also a kind of temporality, because it was part of a bigger shift that was happening within Western societies, where there was, you know, both simultaneously a celebration of a particular kind of inclusion of gay subjects into the nation through marriage equality projects and like the gay rights to serve in the military. So those kinds of inclusive projects were happening simultaneously to massive forms of criminalization of LGBTQ plus people. And also kind of like a kind of necropolitics or death cult around queer and trans people. So, you know, the contradiction between people celebrating the right to marry or the you know, pushing for the right to marry and celebrating inclusion in the military is happening simultaneously to the incarceration and deportation of non-status people who are LGBTQ plus, criminalization of people who have HIV AIDS, you know, the high death toll and murder rates among racialized and in particular Black, trans people, in the United States and Canada. So all of those are kind of illustrations of the larger structure in which, you know, queer and trans people are not really actually included. There's a conditional inclusion of a particular kind of subject. So Puar really identifies this contradiction of, like, gay people being included and simultaneously subject to horrible forms of violence as not, like, an anomaly, but actually as a new technology of a kind of historical moment. And so she started to articulate a way of understanding contemporary nationalism as one that requires, or a form of contemporary nationalism that uses sexual rights as a tool for international foreign policy. And this relationship is really important because not only does it inform, you know, unequal forms of domestic policies that subject particular people, mostly racialized and undocumented or marginalized people in other ways in the United States and in other places like Canada and other parts of the global North, like in Europe, but also justifies the massive expenditure of funds in war industries in the Middle East. So, you know, the United States is now trillions of dollars in debt following the war on terror. You know, there's, you know, billions of dollars being sent in, like, weapons aid to Israel every year. So to justify that, you need a kind of foil in some way. And that foil is often deployed around this kind of civilizational divide in which gay subjects and gay rights in particular are weaponized in this way. So this is kind of like, I guess, the crux of homonationalism. It's not just a set of acts and gestures, but it's kind of like a shift in how nationalism works in the 21st century, where we see increasingly the mobilization of this kind of language being used. And of course, we see it today in justifications for the genocide in Gaza. You know, so we see images circulating of Israeli soldiers, IDF soldiers in Gaza holding gay pride flags amidst the rubble, and, you know, as some kind of supposedly an illustration of liberation for whom. It's unclear. I guess liberation for soldiers who get to express publicly their sexual orientation in a war zone, which to my mind is not really an illustration of any freedom at all. And also through a kind of weaponization of discourses around gender and sexual violence. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we see here in this moment is also how violence against women, how, you know, homophobic violence get deployed as also part of a kind of set of tools to delegitimize legitimate critiques calling for peace, you know? So the idea that, like, you know, how dare we call for peace in Gaza, you know, like, because sexual violence is being enacted. And that's supposedly to, you know, counteract the idea that ending state violence will somehow, you know, like, encourage the acceleration of gender and sexual violence. And the opposite is the case. We know that we know that the conditions of war are co-implicated with gender and sexual violence.
100%. Wow. Thank you. Great job. For summarizing all of this, I find it interesting that you open talking about the symbol of the pink ribbon and ended by talking about these images that probably many of our listeners have seen of these soldiers holding pride flags amongst the rubble that they've created. And to in the last, you know, 61 days, the pride flag is just... It was already completely tarnished for me, but it's like it's over. Like, I can't even swallow it anymore. The same day that I saw that picture, I was at a protest and passed in front of a police station, which had this huge, you know, in the village or in the village area, with a huge pride flag in the window. and it's just like it's over. If we now associate queer liberation and its symbolism to the right to murder with impunity, while we keep dying, as you mentioned, not interested.
Yeah,
personally.
Yeah.
In that symbolism anymore. So you've kind of touched on this, but do you want to go just a little bit deeper in how these issues are interconnected? Like, could you describe in what ways queer liberation and trans liberation is intertwined with Palestinian liberation and with entire imperialism in, you know, more broadly, generally?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, one of the things that people who do social movement organizing work, you know, really have tried to grapple with is the idea that, you know, this tension between between which struggle is the most important struggle, which one do we need to fight for first? And mm-hmm. I think people who've done work in cross coalitional intersectional social movements have really effectively identified that, you know, we can't understand and interpret forms of liberation as distinct from one another, that they need to be co-implicated and co-constituted. So that means that, you know, we can't envision forms of Palestine liberation without also thinking about queer liberation, about trans liberation. And, you know, what that looks like in practice might look a little bit differently in the global North context and in the context of Palestine. But I think that they are struggles that are, you know, both subjected to forms of state violence and state impunity that that require us to think carefully about how we hold our governments accountable and our structures of violence accountable, particularly through criminalization, incarceration, and systemic forms of administrative abuse and violence and neglect. So those are, I think, the kind of like maybe more theoretical frameworks, but just, you know, in practice, like people keep saying that, you know, gay people, you know, homosexuality is criminalized in Gaza and stuff. You know, there's a British colonial law that exists in Gaza still that hasn't been repealed. And it's the same British colonial law that we have in Canada that has also not been repealed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we share the same colonial laws that criminalize sodomy and buggery. And so those laws still are on the books here. They're just mm-hmm. not being exercised in particular yeah. kinds of ways. In the West Bank, where Jordanian law decriminalized and removed the British colonial law, criminalization of homosexuality ended in 1951. We know here that, like, even if gay rights are protected, that homophobia is, and transphobia are rampant. We are seeing right now the abuse of the notwithstanding clause in Canadian human rights law that is allowing provincial governments to violate queer and trans rights in elementary schools and high schools. Mm-hmm. They're coming for healthcare next. In the United States, we have illustrations of like hundreds of don't say gay, anti-trans, you know, bathroom bills and laws that are preventing people from accessing even basic healthcare and medical care. I think that like one of the things that is really important to understand is that regulation and control of people's bodies is a key facet of imperialism. And so if we're thinking about a kind of anti-imperialist movement and struggle, we need to think about the way that, you know, women, trans people, non-binary people, queer people, people whose gender and sexuality are not centralized and normalized in a kind of hegemonic structure, that control over their bodies is a central part of how power is exercised and controlled. And it's a force of domination. So it allows for structures of imperialism to be able to enact violence in the name of nation building or in the name of empire or the name of national security in particular kinds of ways. And so, you know, I think thinking about, you know, attacks on bodily autonomy around reproductive rights, people's access to abortion, medical interventions are actually connected to the attacks on gender inclusive and gender affirming care in healthcare systems. They're connected to education sector. Mm-hmm. And they're connected to foreign policy. And so we have to really think about the way that these struggles are actually not so separate that they're co-implicated. And I think to my mind, then what we really need more than anything is broad-based coalitional work in this moment. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to stop assuming that just because a struggle might be about, you know, the suffering and oppression of one group of people, that it's not connected to other groups of people. And building that kind of broad-based coalition is also foundational for building better allyship and better forms of collaboration for other sites of political protest and liberation. And I'm thinking here about people here in Montreal who organized around the parental rights movement in support of queer and trans people, who came out to support Palestine with queer and trans messaging and slogans. And like that type of cross coalitional work, I think, is more essential than ever before.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree. We have such like an opportunity to do this coalitional work right now. We have to grasp it. Of course, we couldn't record an episode on this day, December 6th, which marks the 34th anniversary of the Polytechnique massacre, in which 14 women were murdered by Marc Lépine here in Montreal, without taking a moment to remember. And also acknowledge that violence against women is still alive and well. And I'm wondering, how might a queer lens help us link, again, in this sense of, you know, coalitional, intersectional? Might a queer lens help us link the genocide in Gaza to gendered violence, and highlight the specific forms of violence that Palestinian women are experiencing right now, without falling into this kind of like women and children first frame of thought that obliterates the suffering of Palestinian men and boys who are so often and so easily dehumanized. You've kind of touched a bit on it, but there's, you know, it. Palestinian liberation is a feminist issue as well as a.
Yeah, I the way I think about it is often to think about the way that violence is a structure that dehumanizes both the subject who is subjugated to violence, so who's subjected to that violence, and also the person who's enacting violence.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to enact violence requires not only the ability to dehumanize the other, but to cut off your own humanity to be able to enact that. And so I think about, in a feminist context, we understand violence to be like cyclical. It doesn't emerge in isolation. And so if we want to think about how to combat forms of gender-based violence domestically, we have to also confront how our contemporary culture weaponizes violence in particular kinds of ways and makes and renders certain people vulnerable through the structure that informs and encourages that kind of dehumanization from the outset. So, you know, one of the things that I'd like to talk about in my classes is that, you know, we tend to think of violence against, like, gender-based violence as an issue of men's violence against women. But the first site of violence that men experience is in the gendering of masculinity in childhood. And there's a lot of research that shows that young boys are socialized into masculinity through exposure to violence. And so violence enacted is then internalized. And we know that people who experience domestic violence are more likely themselves to perpetrate domestic violence. So I think thinking about those kind of like interpersonal structures of violence as also embedded in state violence, like there's no version of liberation that we'll achieve through war violence. It's just not feasible. You know, I think people who've done work in post-genocidal kind of reconciliation have understood that restorative approaches to transforming intergenerational trauma and harm caused by systems of violence is a pathway forward. And I think about this in relation to gender-based violence here. You know, the solution to the Polytechnique massacre and other forms of gender-based violence, like we saw in the stabbing in Waterloo just earlier this year, is not to increase incarceration and securitization on campus by having more police presence, but rather to really transform the way that our public spaces and our society sees the role of feminist projects and women and queer and trans people, that, you know, we don't amplify the kind of competitive the best way to say this is maybe the kind of divisive articulation of these fields as somehow fringe to the interests of our societies and our universities and our institutions, and to take seriously when these kinds of dehumanizing discourses are circulating as not just fringe ideas, but actually things that hold weight and power. And I'm thinking here about like the effect of public figures like Jordan Peterson, you know, and the rise of kind of alt-right politics that have been fueled by this kind of intensification of this way of really situating the problem of our society in gender difference and in not in the structures of harm that are actually causing people's lives to be affected by dehumanization. And, you know, those structures are the structures of capitalism. And so, you know, I think we have to address those things. We're not going to end gender-based violence by just calling for women's rights alone. We're going to end gender-based violence by ending the structures that create violence on the people who enact violence as well. Mm-hmm. So it has to be holistic in this way. Yeah. It's like a transformative justice approach to ending violence.
Yeah. Yeah. I think your response just really like highlighted and underlined something that I already know, which is that one of, like, if we go to the local, or maybe our biggest priority right now is defunding, dismantling, abolishing the police. Mm-hmm. Like, in your response, I really hear how present it is.
Yeah. And to do prevention work with mm-hmm. people who are, you know, not just educating people about, you know, gender-based violence is wrong, but equipping people with the tools to be able to understand the insidious ways that violence is enacted on them mm-hmm. so that they can resist that violence themselves in ways that are productive.
Yeah.
I think that's a key part of it. You know, I'm seeing a lot of weaponization of trauma and harm in ways that is violent. And, you know, I think when people don't know how to channel their pain and their suffering in healthy ways, then it gets projected onto other people in dehumanizing ways. Mm. So, you know, they're hard things to enact and to envision, but I think that I really feel inspired by the people who are doing transformative justice work in their communities to try and like work through how to hold space for, you know, transforming the actions of people who enact violence without simply, you know, dehumanizing them further, you know, in the way in which they've dehumanized others.
It's definitely hard work, but it's not as hard as what we're headed towards if we don't do that work.
Exactly. Yeah.
So again, big question, but maybe the most important one of this conversation, what are some concrete strategies that our queer and trans listeners can adopt right now to resist the lure of pinkwashing and homonationalism, that sandwich you were talking about earlier? And further, you know, how can we materially support the Palestinian struggle towards liberation?
Well, I think the things that people are currently working on right now are really effective, like joining demonstrations, talking about Palestine, like actually just talking about Palestine is really powerful in a moment in which there is like a structural form of silence at the level of our largest institutions. You know, our universities are not talking about Palestine, even though people at the universities are. Our media is not saying the word Palestine. Like literally, they're not saying the word Palestine. They've been told not to say Palestine. They can say Palestinian people, but they can't say Palestine. So those are pretty concrete ways that that we can resist the form of erasure and silencing that's happening right now. Calling for ceasefire, I think, is like that first step. And then finding, I think, also ways for people to build right now, not only their capacity to participate in social movements, to call for the transformation of structures of violence that are leading to genocide, but more long-term, how can we build broad-based capacity for struggles? Like, you know, this fall especially, it felt like there was a convergence of too many terrible things happening all at once. And it felt like everybody I knew was organizing in fragmented ways across those same struggles. And I think that that illustrates something about what the next coming years are going to be like for us, which is that we're going to see the intensification of forms of structural harm that are going to target more and more vulnerable communities. And we really need to build our capacity to work in coalition. Mm-hmm. Coalitional organizing was key to 1960s and 70s social movements and revolutionary struggles at the time. It was the basis of a huge amount of feminist organizing and broad-based organizing for Black liberation, for gay liberation, women's liberation, anti-war movements, student protests, and student rights movements. And so all of those, and you know, so those social movements were run and organized by people from different communities and different who had different identities, but were co-implicated in struggles in particular kinds of ways. And I think the 21st century has mostly been shaped by like interest-based struggles, a lot of buy-in for organizing, which makes a lot of sense. Like people need to feel like they have community that is safe, that is affirming, that, you know, creates space for, you know, being recognized and having, you know, your integrity affirmed by other people. And to also compensate for the structural forms of harm and lack and neglect that we have in our society and to fill in those roles. But I think now we really need to build our capacity for coalition. We need to be building our capacity to work across our differences. We need to work with people that we wouldn't want to work with, mm-hmm. that we don't even like, so that we can try and find ways of working collectively against the structures of violence that are coming at us so much more rapidly and in so much more intensely than we've ever seen before. So I think a lot about, you know, the work that people are doing on Palestine organizing, and this is like a chance also for us to build bridges and connect with people who are part of Palestine solidarity communities who might have themselves become part of the parental rights movement, and trying to start to build relationships to break down the dehumanization that is occurring around how, you know, communities have been subjected to and targeted by particular kinds of right-wing ideologies. And the reasons why people find those ideological arguments and positions appealing is because they've also been targeted, you know, and when you're in a context in which there's lack in competition, it's going to, and scarcity in competition, it's going to feel like anything that is available to you is an encroachment on your access to your rights in particular kinds of ways. And so I'm thinking about the fact that, for example, here in Quebec, Quebec parents are subjected, who are, you know, Arabs and Muslims or, you know, immigrant communities, are subjected to so much racism in our education system. We have laws now, like Bill 21, that, you know, codifies that within the structure of our educational institutions and our, in our society. And so, you know, people are reacting to the fact that they're being subjected to structural forms of racism. They're mistrustful of our educational institutions. Institutions and what happens within them. And at the same time, we have, like, you know, complete cuts to our education sector from the provincial government in Quebec. You know, the cuts to the school tax has had devastating effects on education. I mean, the strike going on right now of our public workers is a testament to the, you know, complete gutting of our public systems that requires, you know, like major resources, an increase in those resources. At the same time, you know, we need comprehensive sex education in the province. And what I mean by that is not just like, you know, access to sex education that includes gender affirming and sexual orientation affirming, you know, education, but also like culturally sensitive, that's responsive to the needs and interests of marginalized communities, that's anti-racist, that includes, you know, cues and guidelines for how to incorporate moral and religious views and beliefs into a system that is not oppressive towards other people, because those two things are not naturally antithetical to one another, you know? And I think that's the key. Like, if we want to think about how to bring about liberation more broadly, we have to, in the moment of struggle, find ways of building those connections with people that we might not automatically have imagined as our allies in other contexts. And that work is happening right now. Mm-hmm. So we should, like, we should really lean into that. Like, we should try and build those relationships to break that dehumanization and amplify our capacity to understand those shared struggles. Because, you know, queer and trans people's opponents are not actually immigrants and religious minorities in Canada. Our opponents are all the same. It's our provincial government. It's our federal government. It's a lack of funding. It's neoliberalization that has caused the gutting of our public systems. It's lack of access to, you know, people who have expertise and experience guiding those processes, like our current provincial government has just announced a committee of wise people who have no background or knowledge in the area in which they're going to adjudicate the future of our provincial government's policies on gender.
With a budget of $800,000.
Yeah. So
gotta remember that.
Really telling.
What you just said, we just have a few minutes. Unfortunately, the time flew by so fast. But what you just said about this like common enemy that we have to identify and coalesce around or against brings me to the question of censorship.
Yeah.
Because, everyone knows in the last few years, maybe 10 years, there's been so much talk of cancel culture and freedom of speech. But here, right now, we're witnessing it being played out with major consequences for those speaking out against Israeli apartheid. And the usual voices who clamor against cancel culture are kind of silent right now. And a notable example last month was Sarah Jama's removal from the provincial caucus by the Ontario NDP, which is supposed to be one of the most progressive parties. In Canada, after her calls for a ceasefire and an end to all occupation of Palestinian land. So when our opponent is the state, and I do believe that Canada is our opponent in this moment, because Justin Trudeau has still not called for a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. There are many ways in which we are collaborating and funding the genocide, and François Legault just decided to open Quebec ambassade in Israel. Great timing, which shows his side. So when our opponent is the state, commitment to justice necessarily means civil disobedience. So what is your analysis of the broad censorship that is happening across institutions, and what words especially of encouragement would you offer to the people who maybe are hesitating to speak out of a fear of losing their livelihood or social status? Mm-hmm. We have like 2 or 3 minutes, but I trust you can say something interesting.
Well, first of all, I'll just say that, you know, people should not, they should weigh their capacity to take the risk in circumstances in which their livelihood might be impacted. You know, like, I'm not encouraging people to sacrifice their ability to live, in their workplace, but there are other ways that you can contribute without necessarily doing that. So I would say that, like, you know, don't let it deter you from organizing, but maybe like think carefully about your social location when you're in a situation where, for example, you work for an employer that has outright said that they're going to fire you if you say something that they don't agree with in some way. At the same time, though, all of us who are in positions where we don't have that same threat have an obligation to speak out. And that is, like, I think the critical mass of how censorship works is that censorship only works when there are enough people who are complicit with that censorship and that silencing. So, you know, we need to, in universities, for instance, in public institutions, in civil society, need to be speaking out much more vocally and more regularly around denouncing forms of censorship that are explicit, which means forms of censorship that punish people and retaliate against them for speaking out in opposition to genocide. But then we also need to fight against implicit censorship, which is that kind of way that we feel intrinsically silenced because there hasn't been a critical mass of people who have stood up against structures of power. And I think, you know, finding people that you can be in solidarity with who will support you in that is really important. And also, you know, the people who have been targeted, they're getting support. You know, there are a few cases of people who've lost their jobs and livelihood through the last 10 years in this organizing. And it's the consequence of concerted forms of lobbying on the part of pro-Israel groups. And, you know, we have a collective responsibility to resist that structure and system and call on our institutions to not capitulate to that or to not adopt and apply those kinds of policies. And so the more that we collectively resist that, I think the stronger we are to be able to improve our conditions of life here and be able to try and inform forms of social change in places like Canada to stop complicity with the structure of apartheid and perhaps contribute more to a transformation of that structure of violence.
Yeah. Well, you did it. Thank you, Natalie, so much for coming in the studio today. I know you're very busy. And
thank you so much.
Your insight is invaluable.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to get to talk to you about this stuff. And it's, you know, it's work that I feel really passionately about. And I feel like I'm so impressed with the kind of organizing that queer and trans people in Montreal have been doing. And I want to see that work, like, amplified. Find more connections.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. This was Natalie Corito. I'm Mycelium. You are still listening to Audio Smut on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's about 7 p.m. Have a great day.
Nuit d'Afrique presents Searching for Goya, a new flamenco production from Soledad Barrio and Noche Flamenca, an exceptional performance in Montreal. 9 world-class dancers, singers, and musicians revive the spirit of Goya. For one night only on Thursday, January 18th at Théâtre Maisonneuve. Reserve your seats now. For more info, visit placedesailles.com.
Welcome back to From Embers, a monthly show that covers anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice across so-called Canada. Today we're sharing an interview I did with Jordan House and Asaf Rashid, who co-authored a book that came out last year from Fernwood Publishing called Solidarity Beyond Bars, Unionizing Prison Labor. I picked up a copy at the Halifax Anarchist Book Fair this fall and really appreciated the clarity of writing in this book. From an outline of the prison labor work picture in provincial jails and federal prisons across the country, to numerous historic examples of prisoner efforts to improve their working conditions, to advancing a fairly compelling political, moral, legal, and strategic case for prisoners' unions as a vehicle for both prison struggles and the labor movement as a whole. In this interview, we discuss the background of the book, some historic and legal precedents, the pros and cons of more legal rights-based approaches, the core strategic arguments in the book, and finally, an exciting new initiative by prisoners in Laval, Quebec to form a union. If you happen to be in Montreal this month, both authors will be presenting at a book launch and discussion at Concordia University on Friday, November 24th at 7 p.m. at the Shift Center for Social Transformation, 1400.